This week, political tensions deepened between the U.S. and Ukraine.
I mean, I think it's a pretty clear shift in U.S. policy, but it was one that we knew was likely to come.
President Trump signals a deal on rare earth minerals is key to ending the war.
I want to have security of rare earth. We're putting in hundreds of millions of dollars. They have great rare earth, and I want security of the rare earth.
Join us now on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
So we're looking to do a deal with Ukraine where they're going to secure what we're giving them with their rare earth and other things.
U.S. President Donald Trump on his plan earlier this month, but Ukraine rejected the first deal offered by the United States, setting off a series of public criticisms by Trump.
I've been watching him negotiate with no cards. He has no cards. And you get sick of it. You just get sick of it. And I've had it.
That was Trump in an interview on Fox News Radio's The Brian Kilmeade Show. Trump said this week that he believed the U.S. had a deal on accessing Ukraine's critical minerals when Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent traveled to Kyiv last week.
Frankly, I wish he didn't go there, waste all of his time like that. But they couldn't get close. They met.
Right.
And then when he wanted to get it close, he was unable to meet him again. But so it was just a wasted trip.
But Friday at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz expressed confidence there would be a deal.
Here's the bottom line. President Zelensky is going to sign that deal. And you will see that in the very short term.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said previously that he directed his ministers not to sign off on a proposed agreement, emphasizing Kyiv was not giving away its resources, but offering a mutually beneficial partnership.
Я дякую кожному з наших партнерів, які розуміють, що потрібні сильні позиції і на фронті.
But in his nightly address Thursday, Zelensky said he had a good meeting with Trump's Ukraine envoy this week on agreements that will truly work, and that he gave instructions to work swiftly and very sensibly.
Що обслуговує війну.
To understand why the U.S. wants the minerals and why they're of value in a deal to end the war, we're joined by Michelle Misofas, a fellow in energy, minerals, and materials at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Sure.
For the very basics to start with, can you tell us exactly what rare earth minerals are and why it seems to be so important for the Trump administration to have?
When Russia invaded Ukraine, one of the first big problems was titanium supply, because both countries provide key exports of titanium into the marketplace. There was a mad scramble by everybody in the aerospace and defense industries to try to make sure that there was sufficient titanium to be able to proceed with weapons manufacturing, and everybody that uses titanium for everything was in the same boat. A lot was done to secure alternative supplies, but within the patch of the cluster of industries that are titanium dependent, this is on a timeline. The sooner the conflict gets resolved, the better off we'll be. Otherwise, we'll have some pretty interesting things to deal with. Rare earth metals, on the other hand, rare earth elements, there are other locations for that, including here in the United States. And there are things that are happening to improve supply. And while Ukraine has that resource, it's going to take years to develop it. It is not anything that is available to us anytime soon. I mean, you know, as you look at recovery in Ukraine and what some of the potential is for us to help with post-war recovery, it would be on the table along with everything else. But titanium is a critical, crucial element that goes into a lot of sensitive stuff, and was already, you know, it was a lightning rod when everything started to happen. Titanium is an issue now, rare earths development in Ukraine could be part of a long-term recovery plan. It would be important for Europe. It would be important for global supply. It would check a lot of boxes. But it's not something that, you know, would come into the market anytime soon. All of Ukraine's resources and all of their businesses, you know, are of interest when you look at, you know, where we would funnel recovery funds and how and so on. And there have been lively discussions already in Europe. We've been party to some about what could be done and how it could be done with what industries in ways that would be creative for Ukraine as well as for, you know, partner countries.
So I think there are two views. I think you're right. I think there is the short term and the long term. And I think the long term here is the second half of the deal. But let's talk, before we get there, let's talk about titanium. What is it used for? You said it's
jet
used in
fighters,
military.
For one thing.
Say it again.
Jet fighters. Titanium is the metal of choice when we look at alloys for aviation. And so it's in most aviation products and to some degree, but it is especially in military hardware. It's a key ingredient in jet fighters and other weapon systems. It's at the high, you know, high-end hearing aids are made of titanium. Bone joint transplants, you know, one of the first things that happened with the invasion was the cost of a knee replacement. They're all titanium based. It's a very nice metal. When it comes to using titanium in healthcare, it turns out that it's very good for healing and other things. It works very well. So it is a very, very important material, but the deployment in key weapon systems like our advanced fighters and drones is really a top concern.
Is it true that the American economy is currently highly dependent on Chinese sources? Does this have to do with economic and national security?
So when it comes to that particular group of elements, the rare earths, the lanthanides, China is the dominant supplier of that material for everyone in the world, not just us. There have been issues with Chinese control of rare earth supply in the past. The Chinese withheld supply of rare earths in a disagreement with their neighbors in Northeast Asia back in 2010, 2011, and that created a very recent, in recent memory, example of what happens when a critical mineral is withheld, that is controlled, you know, by a dominant supplier. The Chinese have rare earth resources domestically that they've developed, but they also process concentrates from rare earth sites around the world. In our case, in the United States, we have a facility that was operating and then went into bankruptcy, has come out of bankruptcy, Mountain Pass, California, trying to get back on track with production. Until a few months ago, 100% of our concentrate was getting shipped to China for processing, which is the more complicated part of the extraction process. Mountain Pass has moved to invest in processing there, but it's been a slow ramp. Rare earths tend to occur in earth with other things, including radioactive materials, in our case, thorium. So when we look at rare earth supply in the United States, if more than 50% or more of your production slate includes thorium, then you fall under the jurisdiction of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which tends to hold up projects. And there's no offtake for the thorium. And this has been, this has made it difficult to invest in and move forward with rare earth extraction projects in our country. There are attempts to look at rare earths in other places. There was the Swedes are looking at it there. They've got a deposit that they want to try to commercialize, but they are years away as well. And so, you know, it is a topic of discussion and a concern across both civilian and defense fronts when it comes to uses and you know, the potential for disruptions.
What are some of the rare earth materials that you think are in Ukraine?
But I suspect that what I would see would be presence of neodymium, which is one of the ones that is of interest to everybody because it goes into magnets, and those magnets have multiple very convenient uses, and you know, everything from instrumentation, high-end instrumentation, like you would, you know, geospatial devices, vehicles, satellites, jet fighters, other things, motors, magnets for motors, electric vehicle powertrains, the motors for wind turbines, you know, things like that. You tend to find rare earth-derived materials in those magnets. And there are other products out of the slate of minerals that go into similar uses, high-end microelectronics being a big category, some into other metals for alloys and so on.
I understand there's also a lot of beryllium there, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, tantalum?
Tantalum, mm-hmm. And those are, a lot of those kinds of minerals are important for things like metals alloys, steel making, other things, you know, a variety of different kinds of products.
And so all of this, what are the broader geopolitical implications over this battle?
Well, I mean, it happens that all these conversations are occurring at a time when both the U.S. and the Europeans, well, pretty much everybody, especially all of the member countries in NATO, have been trying to understand better the supply chains for key minerals and materials that we depend on for so many things, and so it's a, you know, it's a desire to be able to diversify supply chains, so, you know, diminish the influence that the Chinese have. But bear in mind, the Chinese are the ones who have been willing to sustain investment in all these businesses, while in our case, in the case of Europe, people have shifted away from these businesses. They've lost favor for a variety of reasons. It's you know, generally difficult to engage in minerals extraction in our collective countries, say NATO member countries, as opposed to China, India, and a variety of other countries around the world that have sustained mining industries where we have let ours to decline. So, you know, that's a geopolitical risk that everybody is just coming around to recognizing. You know, you let your vital basic industries like that decline over 30 years, and all of a sudden you are where you are in terms of, you know, supply chain fragility. So there are multiple things going on around this that are influencing geopolitical tensions and positioning, not just this particular crisis in this particular situation. This happens to be happening in a bigger context as people are grappling with the fact that we use minerals and metals and for everything. And you know, we have issues in accepting the kinds of industries and processes that are needed to extract them.
So this is just playing catch up, and this is just one little piece of this big,
giant
puzzle.
It is a huge game of catch up, and it happens that, you know, there's a convergence between this big picture push to try to figure out how to catch up. And this is a multi-decadal catch-up problem. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. But what's happening, of course, is it's converging with, you know, all of these delicate negotiations about Ukraine and how to think about a post-conflict arrangement.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for the insights and educating us on all of this.
Well, I hope it helped.
Well, in fact, it did. In fact, it did. Michelle Misofas, fellow in energy, Minerals and Materials at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
A dictator without elections. Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left. Got to move fast because that war is going in the wrong direction. In the meantime, we're successfully negotiating an end to the war with Russia.
President Donald Trump Wednesday evening warned that Ukraine's president needed to hold elections and quickly negotiate an end to the war with Russia or risk not having a nation to lead.
He was elected. He's the elected leader of Ukraine, and he's done what Winston Churchill did in Britain in the Second World War, suspended elections while at war. And our job is to stand with the Ukrainians, support the Ukrainians.
British Foreign Minister David Lammy on Thursday, speaking to reporters at the G20 summit in South Africa, said he saw no appetite from Russia for peace with Ukraine after listening to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, talk at a closed-door meeting.
Peace could be achieved by leaving Ukraine tomorrow, just going. And letting people get on with their lives and letting them have their sovereignty.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine and Russia, retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg's visit to Kyiv this week, coincided with the recent feuding. He and Zelensky's previously scheduled joint comments to the media following their meetings were canceled. And in Washington, U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz Thursday addressed the issue to reporters.
President Trump is obviously very frustrated right now with President Zelensky. The fact that that he hasn't come to the table, that he hasn't been willing to take this opportunity that we have offered. I think he eventually will get to that point, and I hope so very quickly.
Also Thursday, Vice President J.D. Vance, speaking at an annual meeting of the 2025 Conservative Political Action Conference, touted Trump's ability to bring the war to an end.
He, of course, is a very good negotiator, a very good businessman. He recognizes that a lot of these issues are tough. It's going to take a smart statesman to figure this stuff out, but we've got that in the White House, and I really believe that we're in the cusp of peace in Europe for the first time in 3 years because we have leadership from the Oval Office, and we haven't had it in 4 years in this country.
Amid the European concerns, Trump will be hosting meetings next week with French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Joining us now for analysis on the growing rift is Jamil Jaffer, founder and president of the National Security Institute.
Given all of the things that we've been seeing in the last 24 to 48 hours, it seems like the relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine is taking a sharp turn. It seems like it's deteriorating, and now there's sort of a war of words between President Trump and Zelensky. What is your initial reaction to where this appears to be going?
Well, look, obviously, we know who the aggressor in this war was. It was Russia, which invaded Ukraine the first time in 2014 and took Crimea. The Obama administration did nothing about it effectively. And then it happened again in 2022. This time, the Biden administration got aggressive and provided Ukraine, after a short delay, started providing Ukraine with some weapons. And as did Europe, unfortunately, while those weapons certainly helped Ukraine, it has not been enough to get Ukraine over the line to push Russia out. And so now the question is, how do we resolve this conflict? And President Donald Trump has taken the position essentially that Ukraine is at fault for this conflict, which is clearly not accurate. And he clearly has a personal beef with President Zelensky, whether irrelevant who started it. But it's clear that they're not getting along. And President Trump has now been calling Zelensky out on social media. Zelensky's done the same. This is not likely to be an effective way for Ukraine to get its territory back from Russia that Russia is currently occupying, about 20% of Ukraine. And that's going to be a real challenge because Ukraine has been pretty clear that they don't want to end this conflict on Russia's terms. And Russia, I think, would be happy to take the 20% of Ukraine they've taken, keep that, including Crimea, which they took in 2014.
We've heard from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth that it will be very unlikely for Ukraine to get back the territory that has been taken from it. The U.S. met with Russian high-level officials. And of course, this week we've talked a lot about the fact that Ukraine and Europe were on the sidelines for all of this. Can a deal be struck without all of these entities?
Well, look, I think certainly the United States being the single largest backer of the Ukrainian effort against Russia, the U.S. has a lot of ability to change the terms or dictate at some level the terms. Ukraine has to be at the table because at the end of the day, it's territory that's it is its territory that's been invaded, and Russia has to be at the table. Whether the Europeans are or not, they're certainly an important part of this. They should be. But could the U.S. Get a framework deal in place with Russia? I think they probably could. But here's the challenge, right? I think the real fundamental challenge is this question of how much territory of Ukraine's it is going to get back. What's clear to the world is Ukraine should get back, including what Russia took from it in 2014 in Crimea. I think what's clear to everybody is that the 2014 taking of Crimea is probably not at play in this negotiation. In fact, as Pete Hegseth said, the likely scenario is that what we're negotiating about is the 2022 borders. To the extent that Ukraine can does get back all that territory, I think it's probably a deal that Ukraine is likely to do. But we're not in talking about that right now, because right now it appears that President Trump is taking the point of view that the right thing to do is pressure Zelensky, not pressure Russia, which was the aggressor in this war.
Certainly, this is a stark change from how the U.S. has thought of this war and, you know, its policies regarding this war. Why do you think he would say that Zelensky started the war in his own country?
Well, look, there was a claim by Russia from the beginning of this conflict that Ukraine was not doing right by its Russian-speaking citizens in that eastern part of Ukraine. And so the claim was that parts of Ukraine had seceded, had asked to become part of Russia. Russia had agreed, and as a result, it was simply defending now its own territory for a part of a country that had seceded, and that was sort of the Russian position. The United States and the majority of the world, including all of Europe, did not accept that and supported Ukraine in defending its rights on its own territory. But look, during this past election, President Trump was very clear that he thought the war should end, that in fact, he said the war would come to an end before he even took office if he was elected. That obviously not happened. And his position was also very clear that he thought that the war should likely end on terms that were somewhat more favorable to Russia than clearly Europe thought and clearly the Biden administration thought. So everyone knew that going into the election. So in some ways, what's happening now should not come as a surprise. I think there were a lot of folks who had hopes that perhaps President Trump would put pressure on Russia to come to the table as well. But that was never really what we saw during the elections. And, you know, I argued for that in a recent op-ed in The Hill. But look, at the end of the day, you know, President Trump has been elected. He is going to decide on U.S. policy. And if he decides to simply pull support for Ukraine, that's likely to be the end of the war, because it's unlikely that even if Europe did step up, which it's not likely to, but even if it did step up, it probably can't match all the supplies that Ukraine needs to fight and actually win this war. If tomorrow President Trump says U.S. support for Ukraine is done, we're not putting a single more penny in, we're not sending a single more weapon, Ukraine is not going to be able to hold on for very long. They will be able to fight for a while. They'll try to get supplies from other countries, but it's hard to imagine them holding off for a significant period of time without U.S. HIMARS, without U.S. ATACMS, without support for the F-16 fighters, the M1 Abrams tanks that we've given them. Now, it's possible that Europe could step up in a massive way. Europe has shown no sign of being willing to act. Even if they did, it's hard to see if they could match what the U.S. has put in so far.
President Trump called Zelensky a dictator without elections and that he better move fast.
Ukrainian law prohibits the holding of elections during martial law. Now, of course, President Zelensky at any time could withdraw the declaration of martial law and hold elections. And in fact, elections were scheduled for March 2024. Those have obviously, that date has obviously come and gone.
Jamil Jaffer, president and founder of the National Security Institute, thank you so much.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue, available at voanews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, in Washington, D.C., I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.